I momentarily thought I was a robot. All right, so there's no introduction today, and the reason why, I mean, no Kyone Wolf introduction, because I have to write those, and I literally had so much reading to do for the third segment of today's show in the area of quantum physics that it consumed every free moment that I have, and I'm still ill-prepared for that. I think I'm a little bit better prepared for our first two segments. Let me tell you what they're about. Well, I should say in the third segment, we're going to sort of talk about how quantum physics undermines our basic notion of human identity, if it does. I think that's what we're talking about. Is that what we're talking about? I think that is very close anyway. All right, so I bet you can't wait, huh? No, it's actually going to be really interesting. You'll enjoy it. And it'll be a good icebreaker for you at holiday cocktail parties. But first, we're going to talk about other things. We're going to talk about how mass culture, specifically television and movies, deal with the question of terrorism, deal with our anxieties about terrorism, and explore the fraught geopolitical relations in a sort of post-9/11 world. I mean, the answer to that question is not very much. And we're going to talk about why that might be. And then a little bit later, we're going to also, one of the people talking to us will be America's greatest living film critic, David Edelstein. He's going to segue from that to a conversation with me about the movie Creed, which I believe has revived the Rocky franchise, perhaps as no other very stale franchise has ever been revived. I can't think of an instance, maybe you can, of when so much life was breathed into something that looked so completely moribund. But first, we're going to talk about that terrorism question. And the reason we're doing this is because I happened upon a piece by our guest, Maureen Ryan. Maureen Ryan is Variety's television columnist, and she's written a piece about how television deals with terrorism, whether or not, in fact, there's sort of interesting TV being made about terrorism and our response to terrorism and sort of post-9/11 themes in general. And you might ask, well, why is that even important? Why should television do something like that? So let's lead off with this clip from UN Assistant Secretary General Robert Orr. He's talking in 2009 when the UN held a mini-conference on a TV series. It thought this TV series did a really good job of probing issues related to human rights and terrorism. We'll tell you a little bit later what the TV series is if you haven't guessed already by then. But here's Robert Orr.
One thing I think you can get from a fictional world is to get people to think about issues that they don't really want to think about on a daily basis. I don't remember too many people that I've met that really want to think about terrorism or think about nuclear annihilation. But when they're watching a show, maybe they're a little more open to start thinking about those things. So we deal with these issues on a daily basis here at the UN.
So he thought one TV show did a good job with this. Maureen Ryan writes, in this era of peak TV, will any network, broadcast network, or streaming give creative carte blanche to writers who want to delve into the amorphous and ever-evolving war that is being fought with the Islamic State? Battlestar Galactica, Generation Kill, and Rubicon offered worthwhile explorations of the wars of our recent past. Well, actually, Battlestar Galactica, probably not so much a war of our recent past. And 24, whatever its flaws or addictive qualities, undeniably captured the mood of the American mid-aughts. But it seems strange that today Homeland is the only drama even attempting to explore our present geopolitical predicaments. So Maureen Ryan, first of all, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And I guess my first question is, if in fact someone gave carte blanche to creative people to develop such a series, what do you think it would look like? What would happen in it that isn't happening now anywhere?
Well, I think, you know, the thing is, one reason there isn't more of it right now is that the TV is sort of at peak capacity. Like, many people who are interested in these topics already have a show up and running or are coming at it from a very tangential way, I guess. You know, we had shows that were kind of more immersive about it. You know, 24 was very much keyed into those topics, even if it did it in a very cartoonish way often, if it approached it kind of in this triumphalist mode. But there was Battlestar Galactica, there was Rubicon, which was very little seen but was very good. And then the big, you know, kahuna in this arena is obviously Homeland, but I think a few things would need to happen. I mean, I think one of the reasons right now TV seems to be in a mode that is much more personal, not really as political. And I was trying actually to think of, I'm drawing up my year-end lists for best shows of the year, and I'm gonna post a few on Variety.com because there's so many good shows that, you know, I'm going to have a new shows list, returning shows list, overall list. But one thing I've noticed is that a lot of the shows are not really political per se, and the few that are, there's a show called Wolf Hall that was on PBS, but that was set, you know, 500 years ago. So a lot of times with these really difficult issues of war, terrorism, oppression, people seem to respond when there's some kind of pivot that the show does. Either the setting is out in space or it's 500 years ago. There's a show on the air right now on FX called Tyrant, which is set in a fictional country. And I think one of the issues that I have with that show is that it's a little bit too neat. And that's another problem with that TV has with the subject area is that, you know, TV, you want to sit down and watch an hour of TV that feels satisfying in and of itself. And even if it goes into challenging areas, it has to kind of be a story that wraps up within an episode or a season. And that's very hard to do with these incredibly knotty, thorny, difficult issues. So I think, you know, I think one of the biggest problems, one of the reasons why there hasn't been more of it is that I think that there's just not a ton of science fiction inflected TV. TV is much more in a fantastical mode, you know, people trying to chase Game of Thrones or even, you know, zombies or vampires, that kind of thing. And sci-fi seems to kind of have that element to it. There's a new show actually coming out on this sci-fi network, SYFY, the network sci-fi, December 13th or 14th. And that's called The Expanse. And that actually is a political series. It's set in space. There's separatist factions. There are terrorist attacks. So that might be one way that TV is trying to wrestle with it. But I just don't know exactly why there isn't more real-world, here and now, wrestling with the Islamic State kind of shows.
Although you could argue that some of the shows you mentioned do wrestle with the question, as you say, at some remove of religious.
Yes, remove. I think that's one of the stumbling blocks. Like, how do you come at it, and how do you remain respectful of how complex the subject matter is, and yet provide an entertaining hour of TV or season of TV? And that's, you know, Homeland has found it difficult to do that with similar topic areas. And also, you know, you got to think about it too. Like, this is a commercial, you know, medium. It's, you know, there is PBS. There are a lot of adventurous shows being made in Europe, in the UK, you know, here, Canada. I mean, we don't lack for an amount, you know, huge amounts of television being made. But I think, you know, people are looking at the bottom line. And another factor in this is the streaming channels, you know, are kind of still coming online. So Netflix and Amazon are coming late to the game. But another one I would offer is maybe giving us these subjects at that remove is The Man in the High Castle, which is an adaptation of the Philip K. Dick novel that just premiered on Amazon. And it really does have these issues. But I think sometimes people need that lens of the setting has to be in space or a fictional country or at a remove of history. You know, this is an alternate universe, 1962. So somehow it feels safer to kind of explore it from that part of the prism.
Right. We should now reveal that the guy from the UN was talking about the show Battlestar Galactica, which really does, which they had a conference on at the UN, which they felt really was.
I was at that conference.
You were at the conference. All right. So you were not mystified by that intro at all. But it certainly is true that the line between distant history and far distant future is often a little blurry. If I told you there was a series about people who could be burned alive or otherwise executed for reading the Bible in English, you'd think it was some dystopian future thing. But in fact, that happens in Wolf Hall. People who read the Tyndale Bible are killed for it. So you do, at the level of religious fanaticism, we do see that in Wolf Hall. We see it a little bit in Game of Thrones with the Sparrows, who are fundamentalists. So not all fundamentalists are Islamic. We can at least learn that. But, you know, Maureen, you begin your essay with a quote from Roger Ebert. You say, the quote is, "For me, the movies are like a machine that generates empathy." So one of the hopes would be that maybe there could be TV series that looked at this from a more broad perspective as opposed to a strictly American perspective. Occasionally, there are other points of view woven in to even something as broad and as brutal as 24. You might get another point of view here and there. But, I mean, Homeland is the most textured thing out there, and Muslims regard Homeland as a machine that generates Islamophobia, so much so that the show itself was hacked when it hired artists to write graffiti on walls on one of the sets, and they snuck in all this graffiti attacking Homeland for its racism. Here's Stephen Colbert elaborating on why that happened.
And in a statement on their website, the artists claimed they're fighting against Homeland's inaccurate depiction of Arabs, Pakistanis, and Afghans, as well as its gross misrepresentations of the Muslim world in general. Oh, come on, that is not fair. Homeland has plenty of positive Muslim characters, like that college professor who... No, wait, he was Al-Qaeda. Hold on, yeah. All right, okay. That plucky reporter who was also Al-Qaeda. Oh, wait. How about the Iranian intelligence chief who helped the CIA infiltrate his own government after he stabbed his wife in the throat for betraying him? Well, at least there's Farah Shirazi. She's a well-rounded, positive, patriotic Muslim character who was killed by Muslim extremists. Also, I should have said four spoiler alerts.
All right, so that's Stephen Colbert. So, Maureen Ryan, I mean, you know, we think of Homeland. It's on Showtime. It's got good people in it. It is like a guilty pleasure to watch it because you think, well, it's kind of textured. Maybe it looks at the other side of things. Muslims don't think so. I know this from interviewing Mustafa Bayoumi, the critic, last week. They don't think this is textured at all.
Yeah, and I completely sympathize with that point of view. You know, I think that the show is giving us one perspective, and I also think that Tyrant suffers from this to some degree. That it's very much the middle class, American point of view. You know, it's kind of a form of, you know, the cultural nuances and the point of view are very much from a specific point of view, which is, you know, I don't think it adds depth at certain times, and I really do think that this is a problem. You know, I mean, we don't just have a problem with, you know, the issue of terrorism and what happened in Paris and what has happened here. You know, these things are real issues and real things that we need to kind of address through reported pieces and through fiction. But also, like, the people fleeing ISIS, you know, seeing these waves of millions of people fleeing Syria and fleeing the Islamic State, you know, we're not hearing their stories at all. And that's really, well, we are through the news media, but it's fractured. It's, you know,
it doesn't have the complete
worldview of what's happening there. And I think that that's just a huge, TV is on pace to double the amount of content that has come out just even from 5 years ago. But we're not getting some really important points of view that I think could add to our understanding.
Right. And back to the comment from the guy from the UN, you know, you want a kind of narrative arc that fiction can do so well. So one question that we had is, all right, so television maybe not doing such a good job with this. How about movies? Well, of course, we have access to America's greatest living film critic, David Edelstein, film critic for New York Magazine, Fresh Air, and CBS Sunday Morning. Welcome to the conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, Maureen begins her piece with, as I said, a quote from Roger Ebert: "For me, the movies are like a machine that generates empathy." On that basis, looking at these kinds of questions, you would say that the best of the lot on this topic, on American responses to terrorism, was a movie made in 1998, several years before 9/11. Tell us about that movie.
Well, I think you're talking about The Siege, and The Siege was made by Ed Zwick, whose principal concern was the loss of civil liberties. So he actually saw the greater threat to American democracy coming from the, I use this word advisedly, fascistic military response to the crisis. And what he suggested, very broadly, I don't know that the movie necessarily would stand up to scrutiny by a military analyst, was that, in fact, somehow or other, the loss of civil liberties actually helped the terrorists. It increased their effectiveness because too much time was spent sort of messing up connections that might otherwise have been exploited in order to get to the bottom of this bomb plot. So it's sort of like the people who say that enhanced interrogation just leads to more misinformation. Then, in fact, if it worked, that would be one thing. So many of us were upset with Zero Dark Thirty, not because it portrayed very, very brutal interrogation, because it said outright that it was such interrogation that led directly to the identification of the courier who led directly to Osama bin Laden. Now, most accounts, the majority of accounts, say that's simply not the case. But this is a very different, this is a different thing you're talking about. When you introduce the idea of empathy, it's very, very difficult to feel empathy for somebody who threatens you. You know, you had a wonderful show last week on changing one's mind that I found fascinating. But there was one thing you might have left out, which is some of us go back and forth depending on what's happening in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I might sound off about xenophobia and the erosion of civil liberties in ways that would make Glenn Greenwald nod in approval. And then Paris happens, and I'm like, round him up, round him up. And movies, I think, reflect, you know, have a way of going back and forth and reflecting that. It's hard to believe, but do you talk about empathy? Do you remember Bill Maher? Do you remember what ended Politically Correct on ABC?
Was it the cowardly thing, that it
exactly.
was more cowardly to
exactly.
launch a missile
George
from?
George W. Bush, the only way he could figure out to attack these people was to say that they were cowards. And Bill Maher said, listen, you know, that kind of John Wayne talk, you know, it really doesn't, it's not going to help with people who are prepared to get into a plane and steer it into a building and sacrifice their lives. These people might be psychopaths. They might be freaks. God knows he's come out against Islamists, you know, since then in ways that make his politics quite explicit on the subject. But they are not cowards. Even saying that, when we were under threat, was enough to have him branded as un-American and booted out of a show that he'd done pretty well on for many years. So talk about it has to be through Battlestar Galactica, which I agree is a landmark, but only because they were only able to do that because they were working in this very abstract realm in which they could show the evils on both sides.
Right. And so we've got a lot of things on the table here. Let's go back to the siege for just a quick second. It's like the third time this movie's been mentioned on the show in the last 2 weeks, just the way that it's worked out. But here's a little clip from there. This is a movie from 1998. Bear that in mind. I mean, most of the country was just not talking about this stuff.
The situation is appalling. They're attacking our way of life. The president wants it stopped, and there's only one way to do that.
Are you saying the president is prepared to take the necessary steps?
Today, with the invocation of the War Powers Act by the president, I am declaring a state of martial law in this city. We intend to seal off this furrow, and we intend to squeeze it.
Do you have any idea what you're starting here?
It's wrong! What if what they really want is for us to herd children into stadiums like we're doing? And put soldiers on the street and have Americans looking over their shoulders. Bend the law, shred the Constitution just a little bit. We do that, and everything that we have bled and fought and died for is over.
All right, so anytime Bruce Willis is given domestic military powers, you know something really bad is happening. That's Denzel Washington as this highly principled FBI agent. Who's
you remember his great line of Bruce Willis in that movie? It's like, so he's talking about something about your rights, and he says you have the right to shut the F up.
that's probably actually something that Bruce Willis has said in real life, too.
But it's probably something that Donald Trump has said in real life and would say in real life.
Well, so that's an interesting point. Let me go back to Maureen for just a second. So one thing I almost played was a clip from Homeland. It's from the opening episode of this year's Homeland, in which Peter Quinn, who's this kind of soulless but also soulful hitman, explains his whole position about what's going on in Syria. And part of it just sounds like it's Donald Trump talking, you know? I mean, the clip has actually been circulated on right-wing websites. It's like, here's somebody finally talking about what needs to happen. You know, we have to bomb some of these places flat and all this kind of stuff. But I want to go back to Maureen, to David's movie, The Siege. So one of the things that comes up there, in that particular movie, Tony Shalhoub plays an FBI agent of Arabic descent. I can't remember his exact ethnicity in the movie, but he's what some Muslim critics would say is kind of the good Muslim, right? This is one of the few, this really bothers scholars like Mustafa Bayoumi, that you have, the only way that a Muslim can be good is to be a CIA asset or an FBI agent who's investigating his own people. That one of the things that the mass culture doesn't do very well right now is just, you know, explore the mentality of a basically unaffiliated Muslim, or one who's not either a jihadist or somebody actively working against Muslims.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there was a show that came out this year called Master of None, and there was one episode called Indians on TV, and it was just an absolutely scathing but also very funny and very pointed takedown of how South Asian characters have been represented on TV, including through brownface and things like this. And I mean, basically in television, what you had for a very long time was a very tidy, profitable machine that made a lot of money for these big corporate networks. And then what happened about 15 years ago with the arrival of shows like Oz and The Sopranos and The Shield, all this wave of shows. Okay, so it went from being the protagonists of the show have to be white middle-class people, usually white men, to white men who could be extremely, could break a lot of rules and be morally ambiguous. So that was the big breakthrough of that decade. But now we're in, thank God, a much more broadly, we're drawing from a broader pool of potential protagonists. And what's great about those protagonists is that they can be anything. You look at the characters on Orange is the New Black, they're mostly women, and they are engaged in good behaviors and bad behaviors, and all, you know, the whole range of human nature is contained in those characters. And I think that if you try to find just any range whatsoever of characters on television that, you know, that where there's a depth of the characterization, and that's what TV can really bring to the party, is over time, where does this character go? How do they reveal different facets of all of our humanity, but how is it specifically expressed through this person? With characters who are of Arabic descent and or Muslim, it's so thin on the ground that it's pathetic. You know, we have not gone there as a place where, as you say, they're people in the story, and they're nuanced enough that we recognize them as multifaceted human beings. They're not just, you know, the good CIA asset who nobly gets killed so that the white guy can triumph. You know, it's like that scenario we've seen played out enough. Mm-hmm. But I think given what's going on in the world, we need to just have a much more nuanced take on, you know, how these things come about. And I think when we talk about nuance and depth and all that, you know, that clip that you played from The Siege is just, it just sort of feels very relevant to now, absolutely. It feels very relevant to things that you do hear at political stump speeches.
Oh, yeah, no, we're talking about identifying and Muslims, and obviously in The Siege we actually see them interned. We've got the mayor of Roanoke saying, sequestering, that wasn't really such a bad thing. Maureen Ryan, we're almost out of time. I want to just swing over to David Edelstein.
I just want to say I couldn't agree more with what you just said, and I really loved the piece that you wrote in Variety on the subject. I think that movies have tried to handle some of these things. There have been movies like Rendition. There were some left-wing movies that came toward the end of the George W. Bush era, all of which bombed. What I would love to see for all my life and all our lives, we've grown up watching FBI and CIA movies to an extent that have played up this sort of myth of competence. You know, that they always have the purest motives, and they're always, J. Edgar Hoover insisted that whatever you did with the FBI, you always showed them right. I would love to see movies or television shows about a figure like Wen-Ho Lee, someone, you know, misidentified, a scientist misidentified as a terrorist, who, you know, has to live with the consequences of law enforcement making a decision based on imperfect evidence and pursuing it. And you have to go over and over in your head and say, why, when it was so clear that these people were wrong, did they persist in pursuing this man? You could take so many of the people in Guantanamo, the so-called worst of the worst, and ask the same questions. Pardon me, why did they keep them there for so long? These are questions that I think maybe art can handle, that in some ways even documentaries can't. Documentaries do a fine job. We've ignored them. Documentaries on Frontline, you know, all these Pinko production companies like Frontline.
That's actually not technically the position of Connecticut Public Broadcasting, that Frontline is a Pinko Broadcasting.
No. Sorry. I'm taking the point of view, I guess, of virtually every presidential candidate on the Republican side at this time.
Right. Actually, you know, David, we have to wrap this up so we'll have time for Creed. I do want to say that I can pitch the Wen Ho Lee idea on Thursday night at Infinity Hall in Hartford. I'll be doing a one-on-one conversation on stage with Richard Plepler, the CEO of HBO. I'm going to tell him what a great critic Maureen Ryan is. But if you want to go to this, it's free. It's free. It's at 7:30. Just RSVP at HBO Live at Watkinson.org. Or you can email me at Colin@WNPR.org. Come and be my guest. We'll talk to Richard Plepler. We'll pitch David's Wen Ho Lee idea. We'll talk up Maureen Ryan. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk about the movie Creed.
And I do what my television tells me. I don't know why.
All right. Special thanks to Jonathan McNichol, who's put today's scramble together. And thanks to Maureen Ryan. She was so great. David Edelstein is still with us, America's greatest living film critic for New York Magazine, Fresh Air, CBS Sunday Morning. So, David, like a lot of American men my age, I was sitting in a movie theater seat this weekend, weeping profusely at a Rocky sequel. I mean, arguably the sixth Rocky movie, but maybe really just a completely different movie entirely.
I think it's best to think of it not really as part of the Rocky chain, because you notice I don't use the word franchise, which I maintain should be something we confine to Burger King and mobile stations. But it has a different director, it has a different screenwriter. The thing came to Stallone, my understanding is, more or less in the form that it was in. He is quite shameless in the movie in a lot of ways, but the guy has earned it. Let's just say, talk about plucky, you know, talk about taking punches. This is a guy who comes back and back and back, even though, you know, he was able to overcome being a joke for many, many years and fading somewhat in the public mind. So, but it's not a Rocky. It is a Rocky movie, and it isn't a Rocky movie. You've put your finger on what's so interesting about it.
I think also, you know, we're about to see another Star Wars movie, speaking of things that are not going to be called franchises. And you know, one of the things that early Star Wars did so well was kind of tap into this Joseph Campbell kind of mythic language. And some of the Rocky movies have done that a little bit, you know. But this movie really does, this kind of notion of a concealed bloodline. Michael B. Jordan plays this young man who's the unknown, unheralded son of Apollo Creed, you know, this guy who's kind of answering the call of his destiny, you know, and then finding this Yoda-like mentor who happens to be Sylvester Stallone. But, you know, there's, to me, this thing grabs you at a lot of different levels. But one of them is kind of at that level of myth, that notion of a destiny fulfilled. This is a very timeless storyline.
It's that, and it also has something that Star Wars doesn't really have so front and center. It's an assimilationist movie too. The fact that this kid is moving among working class Italians, and in some cases Hispanic people, and it does create a somewhat rosy picture of of this ecosystem that actually is, sure, these people deliver punches in the ring, but it exists to help everyone and to give everyone a fair shot. And I think that what gives that a little more credibility for people like me is that the director and the star, Michael B. Jordan, you know, collaborated, Ryan Coogler, collaborated on a previous film called Fruitvale Station. Now, Fruitvale Station was the ultimate sort of indie Black Lives Matter before the phrase was current movie. It was about Oscar Grant, who was killed under very upsetting and unnecessary circumstances outside a subway car in San Francisco, a Muni car, and the officer who pulled the trigger was exonerated, and this was a guy who's he had a little bit of criminality in his past, but he was really getting it together. He was a father of a young child. He was going to marry the mother, and the movie. I think Coogler, that's one kind of vision of life for a young African American male. This is the Hollywood version. I love the fact that literally this guy's nickname in the film, Adonis Creed, is Hollywood, because he comes from L.A., yes. Adonis Hollywood Creed. But it's useful to think that, well, Ryan Coogler knew what he was doing there. He's saying this is the dream version. This is what we want. This is, as an African-American director and an African-American star, this is the America that we want to see. And we're going to use one of the most hopeful series, not franchises of all time, in order to get this message out. Let's not forget that in 1976, when Rocky came out, what were the other Oscar nominees that year? All the President's Men, the ultimate sort of summation from an investigative journalist perspective of the rot right. in Washington.
And Network and Taxi Driver. I actually know these.
Network and Taxi Driver. And Rocky, you know, which is in many ways the least of them as a film, still managed to score because it seemed so unbelievably hopeful, so transcendent at a time when we were so broken as a culture, when the counterculture had ended in addiction and cynicism and had sort of left the field and there was so little left to move into its place. Ultimately, Ronald Reagan would, but this was this period, and I think this movie kind of taps into the same thing. It's a very smart movie.
It's a very smart movie, but it's also, you know, maybe I'm forcing an analogy, but there's one line I can draw from there to a show like Homeland, which is, you know, we sort of, these days you have to make a nod to subtlety, to complexity, to nuance, to layeredness, and then we sweep them aside and just root as we always have. So Carrie Mathison lets us know, well, this might be a more complicated situation, we might get some things wrong, but no, okay, now let's go get the bad guys. In this case, it's very, I mean, right now it's very hard to make a boxing movie, just the same way it's hard to make a football movie, except the one with Will Smith where he's investigating concussion. So let's hear Felicia Rashad at the very, very beginning of the movie explain about boxing.
I ought to knock you out myself. You know how many times I had to carry your father up these stairs because he couldn't walk? Is that what you want? No, you want brain damage. Yeah, you do. You want to be so brain damaged you can't form a sentence.
I didn't get hurt doing anything.
Apollo didn't get hurt. He got killed. People get killed. I didn't take you in for you to go backwards. You're better than this.
All right, so you shouldn't box.
Wait a minute. Think about this. Think about that. That's so wonderful that you played that, because that's the kind of hard, realistic, textured look at what we know now about the world of boxing that you would not have gotten in 1976.
True.
And it's a weird disconnect, too, that she talks about your father being killed. Father was killed in the ring by Drago, the Russian Superman,
right.
in one of the most absurd comic book, you know, the nadir of the Rocky series,
well,
really.
It was sort of Achilles and Patroclus, too, you know, there's like a little bit of that.
Oh,
hey, before we run out of time on this,
You're
though.
So generous.
Yeah, before we run out of time on this, one thing I wanted to ask you, because you see things in a way that I don't, and I was, as I said, crying for most of the movie. I feel like this director, he really has an interesting visual style, and I feel like everything's he's like the anti-Wes Anderson. Nothing's in the center of a frame. Everything is kind of slashing and cubist and asymmetrical. Am I imagining that, or is there
no.
is there a visual signature here?
Well, yes, he's working with a really great and interesting cinematographer named Maurice Alberti, who came up through. She was actually Todd Haynes' cinematographer, and I think Todd Solon, she came up through the Indies. And again, what they're looking for is texture. What they're looking for is a decentered frame. What they're looking for is lots of stuff on the periphery. You notice when Rocky is sitting by the grave of his beloved Adrian and Paulie, you always see the cityscape behind him. He's a very small figure nestled in the landscape. A lot of the bravura shot of the whole movie is a single shot which takes you into the ring, in which the entire fight is shot from the point of view of the people inside the ring. You're absolutely right, and that decentering of the frame is, I think, one of the things that makes the movie feel more real than the later Rocky films, which were intended to be iconic, to make Rocky this icon. Now we're stepping back. We're moving the camera back a little. It's a very, very smart, rhetorical move, and that's how it sneaks into our bloodstream. You know what I mean? It's why you cry.
Do I ever.
Because you're getting this. You're getting this, but you're also seeing something of the real world, and it's not a fake presentation of the real world. Let's just say it's Hollywood.
It is. A little Hollywood does. David Edelstein, we've got to go. We want to have you back as soon as possible. David Edelstein, America's greatest living film critic. We've got to head down to the quantum level after this.
All the fuss is about. I'm the love child of Willie Pep. You don't see me insisting on a career in boxing. Today's show is produced by Jonathan McNichol and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and our interns are Zachary LaSalle and Amanda Gallagher. The part of Bill Curry was played by Sonny Liston. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Here and Now staff trying to catch a chicken, visit our website WNPR.org/Colin. Tomorrow we'll do a show about placebos, or it'll at least feel like we did. And now, back to Colin.
This is going to be a really good placebo show, and this has been a really great scramble so far. Now, our final challenge, and it's the biggest one. I don't know if we can do this in 13 minutes. We're actually going to try to explain the nature of existence to you in 13 minutes. We can do this. So joining us now is Amanda Gefter. She is a physics and cosmology writer and the author of Trespassing on Einstein's Law, A Father, a Daughter, and the Meaning of Nothing in the Beginning of Everything. Her new story for Nautilus's special identity issue is Quantum Mechanics is Putting Human Identity on Trial. So, Amanda Gefter, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And so maybe we should begin by saying that this begins because of this thematic issue of this wonderful publication, Nautilus. They were doing an issue on identity. They asked all their writers to consider contributing something. So how did you begin thinking about this? Where did your thoughts go?
Yeah, so they reached out and said they were going to do this issue on identity. And with my background in sort of philosophy of physics, my mind went straight to the nature of identity in quantum mechanics, so the identity of particles, which is something that's been sort of stressing out philosophers for a very long time. So I came across this quote by Hermann Weyl, where he said, he's a physicist, and he says, even in principle, we can't demand an alibi of an electron. And I started thinking of that, and I just sort of went into this thought experiment of what would happen if you put an electron on trial for identity fraud, and that's sort of how the article came about.
All right, so we have to, as quickly and as clearly as we can, explain some fairly complicated ideas. So, Amanda, I'm sitting here with headphones on, and we can all agree, at least at this level, that headphones are a thing, and my ears are other things, discrete things from the headphones, and that there must be, therefore, some space between the headphones and my ears, and that 30 minutes from now I will have gone somewhere else, and the headphones won't be on my ears anymore. I'll have moved somewhere else in time. But things are different at the quantum level. Explain why, for example, electrons aren't like headphones.
Yeah, so if you sort of zoomed in on your headphones and looked for the tiny building blocks that make them up, you would see things like electrons. But electrons are very, very different than ordinary objects like headphones, because you could have two sets of headphones that are really, really similar, the same exact make, you know, maybe even the same finish. But if you looked carefully enough, you would be able to find some difference that would allow you to say, you know, this is my set of headphones, and this is her set of headphones. Whether it's like a tiny scratch or even just, you know, using a microscope and finding, you know, like a tiny microscopic difference. So objects on our scale can be very similar, but there's nothing that's really identical. Electrons, on the other hand, are truly identical. And this is sort of a profound thing. Like, you take two electrons, there's literally nothing that you could say that would distinguish one from another. So they're actually the same object. There's no way to talk about one as being a thing that's any different from another. And one reason is because, let's say even your headphones were exactly identical, you would still be able to differentiate them by saying, mine are sitting on my desk and, you know, this other pair are in the other room. So by sort of locating them in space, you can differentiate them. And what happens in quantum mechanics, because things are so weird on the quantum scale, is that space doesn't behave in the same way that we think it does. And so here and there become meaningless terms. And so you can no longer use those to differentiate these electrons. So any two electrons are literally identical to the point that it would be fair to say that there's just one electron.
Right. So this is the point at which, first of all, we know that the Beatles, when they sang Here, There, and Everywhere, were really talking about electrons. This conversation is going to get a little bit, it's going to sound a little bit like Amanda and I have both just taken acid. So there's an old joke about these two old men who've been having the same argument for years. One of them says it's just the same old thing all the time, and the other one says it's just one damn thing after the other. And so there's competing theories about electrons that are kind of at that level. There, one theory would be, if it's just the same old thing, that it's one electron. There's like essentially one electron that's just manifesting itself in so many different ways, in so many that really reality is all being kind of created out of that. Another way to think about it, if it's just one damn thing after another, is that there's an electron field, right, that's just constantly generating new things or more things that appear to be new electrons but are all basically the product of the same field. How did I do at explaining that?
Yeah, no, that's perfect. That's exactly right. So it was John Wheeler, the physicist, had this idea. There's only one electron, and it's just sort of moving in these crazy ways through space and time that it makes it look like there's many electrons. And then the sort of more typical way to talk about it is to say there's this one field, you know, the electron field, and that it manifests as these little particles in all these different places. But in both cases, you know, the idea is that this sort of multiplicity of reality is a kind of illusion, and that everything is sort of one at the bottom level, which again sounds like we're on acid.
Right. So one of the things that you explore, one of the physicists you talk to says it's possible that reality isn't really made of much of anything, which sounds very Buddhist. And I wondered about that too. I mean, in other words, and that's the same thing that you're saying. Okay, so it sounds a little bit like the Buddhist concept of Maya, which is another concept I don't really understand very well. But I think what some Buddhists would say anyway is that that we use our consciousness to create different things, discrete things, individual things, and locate them in certain places and in certain points in time. But that's essentially an illusion. It's an illusion that creates separateness, but our separateness isn't real. What's real is something much more holistic, the idea that we really belong ultimately to one big thing, and we're fooling ourselves into believing in separateness, which sounds pretty close to what some of these physicists are saying.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. I mean, I think physicists get nervous when you use the word consciousness.
Of course.
Because we just don't really know what consciousness is, and so you add that into the mix, and now you're really confused. But I think there's something definitely to exactly what you're saying. And, you know, Einstein had this great quote where he said, space and time are categories in which we think, not conditions in which we live. And I think when you look at these sort of weird issues with these electrons, that's kind of it's one way of interpreting what's happening. So, you know, electrons, one of the weirdest parts of quantum mechanics is that when you're watching them, they behave differently than when you're not watching them. So when you're watching them, they behave like these little particles that occupy a single point in space. And when you're not watching them, they act like these waves that are sort of everywhere at once. And so So you could sort of say maybe that's a property of the electron, that the electron's doing these weird things when we're not looking. But that's sort of strange because, like, why should the electron know whether we're looking or care? So another way of saying the exact same thing would be to say there's something we're doing when we're looking at it that's changing the behavior of the electron. So it could be that sort of space is, as Einstein said, a category in which we think. So we're sort of imposing this framework of space on the electron when we make a measurement. But the electron doesn't really live in space. That's just we're sort of holding it in our minds as being in space while we're watching. And so it acts, you know, a certain way when we're looking and a certain way when we're not.
Actually, Amanda, I thought you put it even better than Einstein. You wrote, in the old way of looking at things, we had space, and then we put things in it. In the quantum view, we have things like electrons, and space emerges as a way to describe the complex set of relations and interdependencies among them, with localized points like here and there peeking through like the tips of icebergs. All right, it took more words than Einstein used, but I thought that was sort of a really interesting way of looking at it. We don't have too much time left, and I did want to swing back to, all right, so you have physicists trying to figure out, describe the nature of reality, and maybe it gets down to just sort of noticing patterns, you know, noticing patterns within this incredibly quantum world. But, you know, the more I thought about it, and I'm not going to connect it very well to your argument because I'm mentally exhausted from having read this article of yours twice. But, you know, I think consciousness still is a problem, right? I mean, it's still the thing that physics can't really explain. Who's doing the noticing? What's doing the noticing? What, you know, it's, you know, they don't call it the hard problem for nothing.
Yeah, I agree 100%. You know, I've been thinking about this a lot because it's currently like the 100-year anniversary of Einstein's theory of general relativity. And so I've been thinking a lot about, you know, what was the amazing conceptual leap that Einstein made in that theory. And sort of what he did was he took something that nobody even considered to be a category within the realm of physics, which was space. Like, space was supposed to be kind of the box in which everything happens. And physics was just supposed to describe the things that are happening. And it was Einstein who sort of came along and said, no, we have to describe the box, and the box itself is doing something. So he sort of like realized that we had to zoom out and include things in physics that weren't originally included. And so you could imagine that on some level, consciousness is the same kind of thing where, you know, we're looking at the world through the lens of our mind, but we don't include that in our description of the world. So there's something sort of missing, and we need to find a way to include that, which is just another way of restating the hard problem. But yeah, I mean, it's like, it's so easy to veer into crackpot territory when you talk about this stuff, but I think it's a genuine problem, and I think it's ultimately a problem in physics.
Right. If you'd like to veer into a crackpot territory, watch the movie What the Bleep Do We Know,
exactly.
Which is why the physicists are so nervous whenever you're talking about things like that. So, I don't know, we've only got about a minute and a half left. There's so much that we could talk about. But where did you come out at the end of this? It's a wonderful essay, and we really want people to go on Nautilus.com and read Amanda's piece. There's no way we can do total justice to it on the radio. But did you stall out at any point here, or do you feel like you have a take on what this all means?
I mean, I think what I came away with that was just so interesting to me was thinking about, you know, to say that there's no things in the way that we typically mean that is actually the same as saying there's no space in the way that we typically think about it. Like, realizing that those were two sides of the same coin was really, really fascinating to me. And then, you know, I talked to this philosopher, James Ladyman, who talks about this idea that we can sort of replace the concept of a thing with what he calls a real pattern, which is just sort of a way of talking about information and being able to compress information. So if you can compress it, then it becomes what we would call a thing. So, you know, we can call you Colin, and then we don't have to track every single molecule in your body. So we've like compressed your information into this shorthand, and that's what makes you a thing. And so it's kind of a way of talking about things without having to talk about space.
Right.
Still, Reese is nowhere in that picture.
Right. We're still stuck with the question of who exactly we is, who's doing this noticing. But that's a conversation for another day, one of those hard problem days. Amanda Gefter, it's been so great to talk to you. Is it Nautil.us? Is that how you find it? All right. I didn't know that. But go to Nautilus and read Amanda's piece. It's terrific. Thanks to Jonathan McPants for producing today's show. Wolfie's been on the board, as usual, doing great stuff with the clips. We'll be back tomorrow with our placebo show, or you'll at least think we were.
Which is still just beyond our grasp. We need a theory of everything. Perhaps the ultimate triumph of science.